In my role, the last few years, I've been quite busy with coverage of climate issues and also quite busy handling complaints about our climate coverage. The other day, an environmental activist really harangued me because she said, "Don't you realise that humankind is at risk from global warming? Surely you should be leading with climate change stories every day of the week." I also get the other side of the argument. How come you're always banging on about global warming when it isn't even true? Someone very unkindly sent me the link to an American blog site where someone had put up a headline, "Is the greatest single cause of global warming really true?" In the way that one's nearest and dearest can really get you. My eldest son, in discussing who gets awards, who gets honours, said, "Dad, you should get an award for services to alarmism for some of my reports about global warming." It's a very tricky issue how we in the media, how we as science journalists get the balance of our coverage right. We're also in quite a tricky time for covering this topic because the recession is long and deep. And I think there was a watershed moment, certainly for me, in mid-September last year when Lehman Brothers went bust. News editors who had been very interested in environmental and climate coverage suddenly were busy with stories about banks and the recession and the financial crisis. And one actually said to me, "Well, you can forget about that climate thing for a while. In the build-up to Copenhagen, how are we going to deal with that?" In many ways, as we approach the Copenhagen Climate Summit, you could argue that there isn't very much coverage. Looking around the newspapers, our airwaves, the programmes of many rival broadcasters, actually, climate is very easily knocked off the news agenda. Gordon Brown, in London, on Friday, gave what many regard as a very important speech about climate change, about Britain's own Copenhagen strategy, with what many saw as a very useful suggestion that the developed world should set up a fund of $100 billion a year to help developing nations cope with climate change. He didn't really get much airtime because a rather strange musician happened to choose that day to die in Los Angeles. That's the nature of the news agenda that we are dealing with. Well, let's open this up to debate. And I'm very pleased to say we've got a very distinguished panel for you this morning, in no particular order. But I'm very glad to say we have Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, who is not only chairman of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, saw through the landmark reports of the IPCC in 2007, helped win a Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore for that work, and now I think starting on the next round of IPCC work due in 2014. Okay, very, very pleased and a very, very busy schedule to have what some of us call catching with us this morning. Sir David King, many of you may know, was the UK government's chief scientist for 7 years, got himself into the news quite a bit, particularly in America, when he said that global warming posed a bigger danger than terrorism. Wasn't a particularly popular remark to make to the last incumbent of the White House, but he's now head of the Smith School for Enterprise and Environment at the University of Oxford. Also with us, Damien Carrington, who is head of environment coverage for The Guardian and The Observer, online and in print. And as many of you may know, The Guardian and The Observer have been in many ways leading a lot of our coverage, certainly in the print world, in the British media. So I'm going to ask each of them to say a few brief words, 2 or 3 minutes only, before we open up to your questions and the debate. I'm very pleased to say this is PowerPoint free. Patrick, would you like to say a few words by way of introduction?
Well, I think the power and the responsibility of the media came to fore, in my view, when they released the fourth assessment report of the IPCC. I remember when the ministers were working with one report, we had a press conference in Paris, and there were at least 350 odd journalists and 50 television cameras. And I think that was the start of extensive coverage of the findings of that report, and I believe that really had a major impact. It need hardly be mentioned that in democracies in particular, it's really the understanding and the stand of the public that would really push leaders in the right direction. And I think much of the inertia that existed among the leadership of the world has now clearly been eroded by the extensive coverage that the media has been provided to issues of climate change. The only point I would make, particularly in view of the recession, which I hope is now bottoming out, but who knows. I think it's particularly important when we're looking at what's gone wrong with the economy. We need to look at some of the fundamentals that were clearly flawed. And if we start going into some depth in analyzing the fact that the world has been on an unsustainable path of development, then climate change would certainly be an important part of it. And there may I say that it's critically important that we see the reduction of use of fossil fuels and therefore reduction of emissions of greenhouse gases as an extremely important part of what will revive the economy. So I don't see any contradiction at all. And this is where I would submit that between now and Copenhagen, if the media could highlight the fact that really speaking, this recession, if anything, gives us an opportunity, gives us a basis for seeing what needs to be done, which is good in itself. And the last point I'd like to make, and this is my final sentence in this statement, I think it would be very valuable for the media to also highlight some of the worst impacts that are going to be felt across the world. And this is where I would submit that a number of underprivileged societies are really going to be very badly hit. This is a fact which is not covered adequately, and I think we need to provide specifics on what's going to happen in some of the poorest regions of the world. I think that would be very important in providing the rationale for action in Copenhagen.
Thank you. There's lots for us to pick up there. David.
Well, David, as you suggested, when I was in government as a chief scientific advisor to the Prime Minister and the British Cabinet, there were occasions when I fairly deliberately, I can say now, used the media as a means of putting pressure on the British Cabinet. And so I'm saying to the media here, you have the critical role to play. The pressure that governments feel come from their populace, from in democracies in particular, and that pressure is driven through the media. You have a critical role to play in that process. Let me just emphasize the magnitude of the transition that we're now talking about. Today we're emitting globally 36 billion tons of carbon dioxide. In order to manage this problem, the scientific community is speaking with a single voice. By mid-century, that needs to be down to 18 billion tons of carbon dioxide per annum. Now, these numbers are rather useful when we bear in mind that also by mid-century, we will have a population of 9 billion people. Simply divide 18 by 9 and you have 2 tons per person per annum is our allowance on the planet by mid-century. Where are we in Britain? Where are we in Europe? 11 tons per person per annum. The United States, 23 tons per person per annum. And I'm saying we've all got to get down to 2 tons per person per annum. India is currently at 1.5. So what this indicates is that we are going to defossilize our economies over the next 40 years. It's not an immediate process. And those assets which are heavy in carbon can be allowed to run their lifetime. But any new assets have got to be low carbon assets. Otherwise, we will have companies building assets that will become stranded as policies sharpen down on defossilizing. And this is going to be global policy. So what is going to happen to a company that simply puts its head in the sand, it's going to go the way of not Lehman Brothers, but the other big crash, of course, was GM. GM is the example of what will happen to companies if we don't begin the process of planning into a decarbonized, a defossilized future. Now, the reason I'm emphasizing this is because we have never in our lifetimes seen the kind of transition we're now talking about. This impacts on every part of our economy. Whether it's the infrastructure, whether it's the manufacturing sector, whether it's the consumer sector, it impacts throughout our society. And Patrick used the word opportunity. This is an amazing opportunity for the innovators in the private sector who will see that they can get ahead of their competitors by getting there first into low carbon. My new school at Oxford was set up to work with the private sector to bring governments and academics into this discussion in a global forum to see that we avoid becoming stranded assets as we move forward in time. Now, what this means is the economists claim that they can calculate what the impact of dealing with climate change will be, but defossilized. I don't believe it. What I would say is, 1%, 2% of global GDP, how do you get that? How many stranded assets can we avoid as we move forward? That means that any economy, any country's economy that doesn't encourage its private sector to avoid assets that are heavy in carbon, building new assets, that those countries will find that the transition is expensive. Whereas if we now encourage our private sector into this route, we've got a way forward. Now, I'm sorry to be at a bit of length, but let me emphasize this point. Copenhagen is faltering at the moment. At the meeting in Bonn a few weeks ago, we had several countries stepping into the breach left by the Bush White House regime. What I mean is now the Americans are fully engaged in discussions on how we achieve a good protocol, but there are several countries, and I would name Japan and Canada as the leaders of these, who are stepping into that breach and blocking the process. There's no room for complacency here. We need an appetite for change in the shortest possible time so as to avoid massive expense as we manage this transition. We have time now to do the transition in a smooth way that will avoid stranded assets being built. But if we go on messing about and avoid a decision at Copenhagen, we're just going to make it a whole lot worse for ourselves as we move forward. Back to the media, you have a critical role to play.
Thank you very much for this. Thanks, David. As the sort of journalistic intruder on this very eminent panel, I'll keep my remark to the media. Effective numbers. The first thing I want to say is just kind of briefly what our approach to reporting the environment in general, Copenhagen in particular. I think we've seen three main strands. The first one is presenting the science that's actually happening. And in some ways, that's actually the easiest. Rich Engels is completely right about 2007, his report then being a tipping point. From that point onwards, it's been undisputed and we've been able to update that as we go along. The second strand is keeping people honest, holding people's feet to the fire, particularly governments. And certainly at The Guardian over the last year, we've run many stories where, you know, we have found that in back rooms, in negotiations, in Brussels or other parts of the world, officials are arguing the opposite of what's been portrayed in the front of the house by the politicians. And so that's certainly perhaps our most influential role, our most powerful role. Certainly, because the first two can be quite depressing, I think we, The Guardian and Observer, think strongly that we need to also have a strand which shows people why this matters. I call it the
celebrating the wonder of nature, the joy of nature. Sometimes that's about why it matters, it's also about adaptation, which Jennifer talked about earlier, which again is kind of gloomy, but we certainly try and celebrate the natural, the wonder of the natural world. Now, as I mentioned in the Guardian, and we've made a big push into the environment, we've got 6 full-time correspondents now, and we're very lucky to have backing right from the top. I know that isn't the case across the industry by any means, and in fact, you know, our numbers are dwindling in many parts of the world. Even in the fortunate position that we find ourselves, it's still not easy. You know, the process is a very complicated one, things like technology transfer, the funding mechanisms, cap and trade, clean development mechanisms, all these are very difficult topics to sell in a general newsroom when you're sort of competing with Michael Jackson collapsing banks. I mean, just one example, though, again, we have, you know, a lot of support. One of my very senior editors told me, not long after I started the job, I've never read a story with the word emissions in. It looks too boring. So, you know, that's probably an example of the challenge that we face, and hopefully we can have a discussion about how we might overcome that.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, it's now at this point that we open this up to your questions and very much a sort of interactive Q&A. I mean, a couple of things that I've got very much in mind is, as one of my editors put it a couple of years ago, is it our job as journalists to save the planet? Is it our job to report scientific findings, to report developments, or is it our job to go further across into some kind of campaign, and given what everyone's been saying about the critical role that we in the media play? And secondly, particularly aimed at science journalists, there are uncertainties in the science. The IPCC Fourth Assessment Report recognises all the way through varying degrees of uncertainty. That's how science operates. There is perhaps a danger, some of you may want to ask questions about this, about whether we ride roughshod over some of those uncertainties in our effort to simplify our story and just say scientists have found X or Y, when in fact there are probabilities and all kinds of doubts and questions and qualifiers attached to that. So please stick your hands in the air, one at the back. Now, do we have roving microphones? We do. Just please, and do just say who you are and where you're from. Yep, have it back there.
Hello, I'm Richard Scrace. I'm a freelance journalist based in the UK. This is a question for all four of you, really. I'd like you to imagine our decarbonised economy in a generation's time, 30 years from now. How is it going to be more pleasant for us as citizens in our economy to live in this decarbonised world? I'd like just to come up with one idea of why you think it's going to be a nicer place to live. So I think part of getting the climate change message across is painting a future that people can buy into.
I would say, firstly, you'd have much lower levels of air pollution at the local level, and therefore commensurate health benefits. You certainly will have higher levels of energy security, because if we're going to use energy more efficiently, if we're going to use renewable sources of energy on a large scale, then clearly all of these will give us a higher level of security as far as energy supply is concerned. And finally, I think even when it comes to the impacts of climate change on agriculture, you certainly have higher levels of food security, because otherwise we certainly are going to see, as we brought up in the Fourth Assessment Report, there's some countries in Africa where the decline in yields of certain crops on account of climate change as early as 2020 would be about 50%, a 50% decline. And these are countries that already have massive malnutrition. So I think the world overall will be a much better place for these reasons.
Thank you. So this is really about a message from the media being more optimistic rather than pessimistic.
I think 2050 is going to be a test time. I think we are talking about decarbonising, but we also have to manage a population of 9 billion. So there's the double challenge, the overall resource and what we're doing to the planetary environment. Defossilized system, we're going to see a massive change in building structures. We won't in future, I think, sit inside a building with sunlight pouring onto the roof outside and putting lights on inside. Why not have light pipes? There are very simple measures that can be taken to save energy. We will see, particularly in the transition, this improvement in our building design capability, both in terms of passive air conditioning and passive heating and solar lighting, direct solar lighting. We're going to see, in terms of mobility, the biggest change, probably. I can see short-haul flights in the shorter term being phased out in favour of land travel, particularly with improved fast rail. So we're going to see fast rail taking over from the short-haul flights, which are most expensive in terms of carbon dioxide production. Long-haul flights will continue, but I'm absolutely sure we'll see much more of the new video conferencing facilities, not using satellites that continually break down, but using broadband. We'll be walking into conferences with people from around the world, all appearing on screens as if they were there. And we will have body language and all the context that we used to. So much less international travel as well for that reason. A lot of business will be conducted in that way. And we will see, in terms of our consumer capability, that we will, I believe, have to have made a transition into a society which understands that well-being is not served by massive consumerism. I think that is probably the biggest cultural change that will have occurred in the previous 150 years. Consumerism has been a wonderful instrument for driving our economies forward in the 20th century. It's not fit for purpose in the advanced countries in the 21st century. Now, hopefully, just to come back to the point that Patrick made, working with the developing world to see that they have managed to deal with the impacts of climate change is going to be one of the biggest challenges we have, but also working with the developing world in leapfrogging to low-carbon futures.
Okay. And that's a bit of a risk, as a newsman, is that if you do too much, as it were, good news, it can look a little bit soft, a little bit sort of green propaganda.
Yes, no, that's absolutely the case. I mean, we've talked at some length about the idea of making the future seem less forbidding, less pear-shirt, and we've certainly done that in news terms, as David points out. It's an extremely difficult story to tell. But technology is one area where you're able to do that. There's a kind of shiny future. We've done a lot around electric cars, for example. I'm not a petrol head, but those who are, the acceleration you can get from an electric car is actually fantastic. So I think there are certainly opportunities for that, and it's very important. I think the one thing I might add to the things that have already been said is about shipping. Actually, shipping is the most extraordinarily dirty industry, causing health problems in coastal cities all around the world, including London. If the low carbon future can address that as well, then I think it will be a brighter place.
Lovely, thank you. Next question.
Yes?
Thank you very much, and do just say who you are and where you're from. Thank you.
Janet Boston from the Thompson Foundation. I'm interested, what's your advice to media and those working with the media in the so-called developing or majority world faced by the effects of climate change now, which have actually been caused by northern consumption? How do they tackle it?
Well, who's the question aimed at?
The whole panel.
The whole panel. All right. Well, okay. You're going to have a go that way.
Is that
your question? You really want to know how the media should cover the impact of climate change on developing countries? What advice should we give? But just to clarify, advice to the media of developing countries about how they should cover their own impact. Okay. So to journalists from developing countries covering impacts of climate, what advice? Because you can't always link a single weather event to climate change, can you?
No, it's certainly difficult. If I think of a good example, I just sent someone to Zambia to look at the flooding of Zambezi, which is happening earlier and to a greater extent than it has before. David says you can't necessarily link that, but if you look over the long term, there certainly seems to be a trend. I mean, I think, you know, I'm slightly hesitant to give people advice in countries I don't visit, but I think maybe the single piece of advice is to humanise the stories. You know, if we're talking about the science, you know, the graphs, the statistics, it, numbers that win people's minds over, it's human stories. And that's certainly where we start our reporting on these topics.
But it's fair to say the awkward thing is, and Patrick, just to throw this at you, really, to pick that up, the worst effects are forecast for the back half of this century. So, as a TV man, I go off looking for examples of human impacts of climate change, and actually, right now, it's very hard, isn't it, to say that drought, that flood, that failure of the monsoon is because of climate change.
Well, I think one has to be very intelligent and somewhat research-minded and be able to cover some of the impacts of climate change in the developing world. Let me give you an example. You know, last year there was this cyclone Nargis in Myanmar, which supposedly killed 100,000 people. The numbers now indicate about 140,000 people. Now, certainly we can't say that this was caused by human-induced climate change, but we know that if the sea level had been a little lower, the extent of damage would have been substantially less. Because typically when you have a continental shift, you've got water sitting on it. When a cyclone hits a region like that, it picks up all that water and burns it on shore. Now, if you have a larger quantity of water because of climate change, then clearly that's going to make things much worse. I also want to highlight the fact that, you know, if you look at floods, you look at droughts, you look at extreme precipitation events, and I'm not talking about any single event, just look at the trend. And you get a very clear idea of what's really happening. Now, in India, we've just done some very preliminary work, and it's not definitive at all. But we find in some of the areas which are worst hit by the impacts of climate change, poverty is actually more. Now that to me is an extremely telling example of what impacts of climate change actually do to human society. So I think there's a whole range of things. If we were a little more analytical, we were to sort of go to the right researchers, we'd be able to get a lot of information that might be valuable.
But in fact, there is a risk of blaming too much on climate change. I'm thinking of the UN Environment Programme a few years ago blamed or described Darfur as the first climate conflict, which you could argue let a cartoon government off the hook.
No, I think that's ridiculous. I mean, one should never get into that kind of position, because if anything, you're just going to lose credibility as a result.
Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think it's very important that we understand there are a number of extreme events that become more and more extreme because of baseline changes, such as sea level or temperature. So, for example, the hottest recorded summer and the biggest natural disaster in terms of human lives in Central Europe was the summer of 2003, estimated 32,000 lives lost. The hottest summer of the 20th century in Central Europe was 1947. The average summer temperature in Central Europe is now the same as the hottest in the 20th century. So when we have an extreme event, it's on a much higher baseline and the impact is much greater. So while we can't say that event is due to climate change, we can say because of the higher baseline, the impact is much greater.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, as I had in the air there, I'll try and get to as many as possible. Perhaps just give one hand.
Hi, I'm Justin Davies, freelance from Scotland. How can we balance increased economic growth with increasing defossilisation of our fuel supply and still keep lives pleasant for people like me who live on the top of a hill in Scotland?
Can we just run through it again? I think it's not brilliant up here. Yeah. I heard the last bit about life on a hill in Scotland and how can you keep life pleasant? But what was the first bit?
Wind farms, I mean, how can we increase economic growth and defossilise our fuel supply and not ruin the lives of many people who live in the countryside?
with lighting them with wind farms on top of a hill. How can you improve life and decarbonise without spoiling the wonderful Scottish hillsides?
There's something interesting here about your attitude of mind when you see a wind turbine and your attitude of mind when you see a power cable line. So we don't like to block our beautiful landscapes. Of course I understand that. But at the same time, I've got this lovely story told to me by a man who heard a talk I gave on this subject in 2001, went back to a small village outside Bristol, persuaded the local people to allow him to put up a large wind turbine. And the local people now get, every month, from the electricity utility, a check. They don't pay a bill. They're putting more electricity onto the line than they're actually having to use. They've already paid off the capital cost of the wind turbine. And he told me the attitude of the people in the village towards this thing they first thought was an eyesore changed enormously as they realized it was a cash cow. So the attitude of mind is actually quite important. But I do think we have to preserve parts of our heritage and our countryside, of course. So we've got to be sensitive about where we build.
Thank you very much. Question here.
Yeah. I'm Jack Knopf, China Science News by Weekly. I have been organizing media training in climate change reporting for 3 years. So thank you very much for your stress of media's important role in climate change. But my question is, despite continued effort in China, climate change cannot become the media's central agenda. So my question is, in the UK or in other country situation, do you think it is first media make climate change as a central agenda, then politicians take action, or further because the government say we will cut emission, then it will become the media's central agenda? Thank you.
Okay, so the question really is climate ever going to be central, mainstream to news coverage? And if it isn't,
the evidence is central, but this is everywhere in the world, but in the situation in China, maybe be some developing country, it cannot become the central agenda in the media reporting. But here
to what extent, despite your army of people on the Guardian Reserve covering this topic, are you yet mainstream at the core of the newspaper's coverage?